right. Good to see you all tonight. Glad you're here. Dave's going to lead us in prayer tonight as we begin.
Father, most gracious God, we're so thankful for your many bountiful blessings that you shed on us each day. And we are thankful for tonight that we can come together and be in your presence and to study your word. We pray that we'll learn new things that will help us to be more and more fruitful in your kingdom. Help us to be brave and bold and be able to talk to those that are in need of salvation.
Amen. Okay, what we're doing tonight is we're kind of finishing up some thoughts in our study of church history. We're not done, but we're done for now. Rick's going to be starting his class on Sunday, the book of Ephesians. And so... he's going to be gone some in April, and I think that I may try to go back and pick up some things in April when he's gone that we're not getting to right now. But what we were talking about last in this class was kind of a period of time that was just really ugly as far as the Lord's church goes, in the 1950s and 1960s. And it's not really pleasant to kind of go over some of these things, but as we have seen and discussed before, I mean, we have been weeks and months coming up to this point, and we've seen some patterns that's happened over and over. And I hope what we have seen is that there is a purpose and there is a reason to understand and to study history, because if you don't understand history, often you repeat some of the same mistakes. And I think we see some of that in the 1950s and 60s with regards to the Lord's church. That's some things I want us to talk about tonight. I want to mention real quick on this timeline. Different ones have asked, you know, for a copy or trying to make copies of it. I can make you a copy of this if you want this timeline. You let me know and you remind me. I can email it to you or we can print off copies. You let me know what would work well for you and we'll be glad to do that. Now, I have to try to find where I want to back up to. Okay, sort of like right here. What we were talking about last, some of the events of the 1950s, there became an extremely divisive period of time. And churches of Christ split all over this country. In fact, there was hardly a church that was not affected. In fact, I don't know of a church that was not affected by the issues of the 1950s and the 1960s. And what led up to this, there was, as we saw and we discussed some, there was first some interest in the earlier part of the 1900s about support of schools, support of colleges that did Bible teaching. And when that first came up, around 1910, pretty soundly it was defeated from the idea that there was no Bible authority for churches to use collected treasury to support such things as schools, Christian schools or not, as some would say. And so that kind of went down for a while, but there were still some rumblings because there was a period of time where there were some schools that were started by brethren that were really struggling. The war came about, World War II, another period of time that was very difficult. But after the war, there was an increased interest in evangelistic work overseas, in both in the Asia area, region, and in Europe. And there were some churches that started some large evangelistic programs of sending preachers into these areas. And there was the sponsoring church concept that really got started. We talked about that before. Churches sending money to a larger church, and that eldership would oversee a work that was larger than the local work of sending preachers out, sending money to preachers in other places. But still, getting support for colleges was something that just really wasn't happening so much. In the 1950s, the subject of supporting orphans' homes came front and center. And at first when that came up, there were those who kind of stood back against that and said, no, no, we can't do that. But over a little bit of time, there were more and more that grew to have interest in saying that from the church treasury, it would be right to support orphans' homes taking care of orphans. And the primary passage that they would turn to is James 1 and verse 27. And it very simply says, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and visit the orphans and the widows in their trouble and keep oneself unspotted from the world. We've talked about that passage before, and I'm not planning to spend a lot of time discussing that tonight. But it was from this particular verse, some others that were turned to as well, but this is the one that many would turn to and say, see, the church has to support the needs of the orphans. Contextually, you can't get there. Contextually, throughout the chapter, it is a chapter that's talking about individual responsibility. It does not change in verse 27. And what does it mean to visit or to care for the orphans and the widows? That's a discussion in itself. But the point being is that this was the turn to passage for many to say that churches needed to be about the business of supporting orphans' homes that took care of orphans. Oh, there were so many issues that came up with that. Were there even really truly orphans in those homes being one? But this is what really started dividing the wedge. We talked some last time about those who are called antis, those who are anti-cooperative. It turned in an extremely negative turn. Those antis don't love orphans. Those antis do not care about the widows. And it became a brutal kind of scenario, brethren who are acting like the world and not acting like brethren. And churches divided. There were two very different mindsets that became very prevalent on how the treasury was to be used. There were those who were very careful and said, we can only follow the pattern, the examples that are set in Scripture. There were others who took more liberties with how it might be used. It was a very, very difficult time among churches of Christ. Division took place. Battle lines were drawn. And it's not going too far to say there were battle lines, because there were. And they were very, very deep battle lines. And the attitudes were ugly. They were divisive. On both sides of the issue, there were those who did not demonstrate the kind of attitude that they should have had. Attitudes that were just indefensible. And again, we talked about this idea of the antis. The antis were those who were opposed to supporting from the church treasury such things as orphans' homes. The antis were depicted as those who hated orphans. And so it was a very negative connotation to the idea of antis. And so this division continued to just grow, and it grew to epic proportions. As I said, I can't imagine that there was a Church of Christ anywhere in this country that was not affected by the division, by the strife that was taking place. It was an incredible controversy. There were some churches that may have skirted the issue for a while, but in time, they were all affected. Preachers were fired. I mean, it came to the point where in such an ugly way, you know, preachers had to take some kind of a stand on where they were on the issue. And many were not prepared and were not ready to take a stand on the issue, because they hadn't studied it well enough. But here there were some in churches that were putting the pressure on them and saying, where are you at on this issue? Many of them knowing that there was a growing number within the church that was in favor of using the church treasury, maybe in ways that they did not support or agree with, but knew that if they tried to make a big issue about that, they would be shown the door. Sometimes quite literally, and sometimes that very day. There are preachers who were living in that period of time. Many churches had a preacher's house next door. And there were literally some who were fired on Sunday, and their belongings were moved out of the house on Monday. Not that they had any place to go. Not that they had any place to put their belongings. That's how ugly it was. No excuse. I mean, there is no rational explanation to some of the things and some of the events that took place. Brethren had become so emotionally churned up over this issue that rational thinking had gone out the window. But beyond that, forget rational thinking. brotherly love had gone out the window. And it was that case on both sides of the issue. Those who were for using the church treasury for this purpose, those who were against. You know, we mentioned last time how there were families, how churches would split and how families very often were split. Often there would be large families, you know, involved, some on one side of the issue, some on other. Families who would turn out go, you know, decades without even speaking to each other because of this issue. It's hard to imagine. For some, it's hard to imagine. Some of our younger people here who did not see any of this, I hate to even have to bring it up and say, here's the ugly past. But we need to understand something about that ugly past for fear that we repeat it again. It's some things for us to think about with that. So the ugliness continues. You know, through the early part of the 1960s, churches were still splitting. In the 50s, it was some of the, could I say, more prominent churches, some of the larger churches, primarily in the cities, where this was happening, where it was taking place. And it kind of spread. It went to the smaller cities. It went to the rural churches. It took a while to get there. There were some churches that maybe kind of stayed out of the fray for a while. And there were some churches that were kind of trying to ride the middle of the issue, not take one side or the other. Some churches, even where there were those inside who knew they didn't necessarily agree, but were trying to get along. I've painted an incredibly negative picture because it was just such a bizarre time, and it was negative. But there were those who were trying to sort out the issue. And there were some who were trying to get along, even though there were different conclusions that had been drawn. But there were some men who were determined that their conclusions would be what all the brethren would see and understand and agree to. Debates took place, and then more debates, and debates about the debates. And so often, the debates that I've read in the books, there's books published on this, the books that I've read, I don't get very far into those debates. I've never read a debate book all the way through. It just gets me too aggravated. I get angry. Disappointed kind of angry. That brethren would speak and talk to and about each other in the way that they did. You know, in some cases it seems so much like it wasn't about what is the truth of the matter, but can I win the debate? And again, no excuse. No excuse can be made for some of these things that took place in this period of time. In the 60s, early part of the 60s, there were still some churches being affected by this. Some parts of the country, some of this took place a little bit sooner than in others. And in some places, rural churches didn't get affected by this till a little later. I was in a small church in a small town in 1982 that split over this issue. And that was propagated largely because we knew we had some different ideas on this issue, but we were at that point able to kind of get along and have some understanding of each other, and there was some efforts to study on the issues until a preacher came in, an institutional preacher came in, to sort this problem out and preach the antis out of the building. And he accomplished that, and the church split. And so there were still those on the peripheral in the early 80s even having to face, you know, these issues. By the late 1960s, for the most part, the division had taken place. The effects of it were still very real. Very raw. And the animosity was still there. But for the most part, it had moved on. There would be other issues that would come along because there always are. There will always be other issues that come.
You know, one of the big things that really got the push going for the more liberal side of this was the Herald.
have that getting such prominence on TV when TV was in its infancy.
Mm-hmm. A lot of power.
A lot of power, a lot of persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
You had two groups. You had preachers that were coming out of Hardy College in Searcy, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
A little more conservative at that time. And then you had, of course, the other people coming out of Davidless and Nashville, which was going very liberal.
Going farther out.
Farther out at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And being going up to North Mississippi, we were catching both ends of this.
So you're hearing both sides. Mm-hmm.
More conservative shit, we say, back then. And so, being the preacher lived across the street from us.
You heard a lot what was going on.
A whole lot of this growing up.
Last time, we talked some about like the Herald of Truth. You know, the movement that got started of, you know, church in Abilene, Texas, that's going to take on this work, bigger than what they could do. This national radio program, TV program, Herald of Truth, send money to us, we will support this. And that raised a lot of eyebrows for a lot of folks. There were those who were opposed to that. There are many churches still not supporting that. Because they said, I mean, that that whole organization is wrong. The idea of sending money to a church or to an organization to do the work that the church is supposed to do is wrong. But what happened with the orphans issue was an emotional issue. I mean, taking care of these babies. You know, you don't want to be an orphan hater. You know, you have to love these babies. It's emotional. And so a lot of people started saying, well, we've got to take care of the orphans. We've got to take care of the babies. And once churches started doing that, sending money to an orphan's home, that did this work that they thought the church needed to do. Well, what's different with that than sending money to Abilene, Texas, the church there, to do the Herald of Truth? There's no difference. Or, what's the other issue that started that got nailed down? No, after that, in the 1900s, the supporting of the colleges, churches, all of us said, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. But what was the first? I mean, that was the first issue. It got thrown down. This is my thoughts here. And it's not just my thoughts. Some others come up with this. The issue of some brethren was getting money to the colleges. Most brethren saw right off, there is no scriptural authority to send money from the church treasury to support a college to do the work of the church. And so when the Herald of Truth came up, or sending monies to sponsoring churches to do evangelistic work, that met some opposition at first, but then some started coming on board on that. Still a lot of churches opposed that. Then the orphans issue comes up, taking care of these babies, an emotional issue, emotional beyond I can even describe. And when churches, one by one, by another, by another, by another, started supporting the idea of sending money to orphans' homes, someone stood back and said, well, hey, if it's right for a church to send money to an orphan's home to do this work, what's wrong with sending money to a church to do evangelistic work? It's the same pattern. Who can deny that? And of course, there were those ready and waiting to say, well, what's different with the pattern of churches sending money to the colleges to do this work? They all stand or fall together.
Well, they got to seeing that the denominational world was training their people to go out to evangelize.
I think that's where it started.
And that was the justification.
In the early 1900s, before any of this came up, the denominations already had their seminaries, they had their colleges, you know, that their churches were supporting. Churches of Christ were not, because there's no biblical pattern for such a thing. But there were some who suggested maybe this could happen. Nope, that got nailed down. Can't do that. It took another 40 years for other avenues to kind of come up to start putting in place the idea of sending money to a sponsoring church or to an organization to do a work, and people slowly start accepting that, and then through the emotional issue of the orphans to start saying, okay, we've got to do this, for someone else to stand up and say, well, hey, if you can send money to an orphan's home to do this, you can send money to a church to do evangelistic work, or you can send money to a school. Once that door was open, it's never been closed. It's only grown. I'll always wonder if the intent of some, I mean, they went to this extreme to give money to the schools. That was knocked down at first. And it took all of this other to bring it around. I mean, once you set that pattern, and once you agree to that pattern and some other thing, you can't deny it for this. As unbiblical as it is. And so by the mid-1960s, there were a lot of churches of Christ that was using money from the treasury to send orphans homes and to send to other churches doing evangelistic work and sending money to colleges. Now colleges are receiving support from churches to do the work of teaching youth and teaching preachers, young preachers and things like that. And it's never been backed up because you don't back those things up. I mean, once you broach Bible authority being the conduit for what you do or don't do, once you go beyond that, there's no backing it up. You can leave and you can go somewhere else, but you can't close that door again. And that's where it kind of stands today. And so by the end of the 1960s, there are those who say and estimate that 80% of the churches of Christ in this country had gone that institutional direction, about 80%. And churches that, we might call as institutional, we talked about this before, institutional, that is, they support institutions out of the treasury, or some say liberal churches, or as they would prefer to be called, the mainstream churches of Christ, is how they would designate themselves. And for the most part, use of the treasury, when all this first happened, the main thing that would have separated us in the 1950s, the main thing that did separate us in the 1950s, 1960s, was the use of the treasury being sent to man-made institutions. I mean, by and large, any other preaching that took place regarding salvation, moral issues, doctrine, we would have been in agreement on. But churches have, though the mainstream churches, as they might be called, have continued to evolve. Let's add another issue among churches of Christ in the 1960s, latter part of the 1960s and into the 70s. There were some churches of Christ, particularly among the mainstream churches of Christ, as they want to be called, to look more like their desire to look a little bit more like denominations. To do some of the things that the denominations are doing. There was a movement that some have called the social gospel movement of that time, 60s and 70s, through the present, you could say it still exists today. And there were some who vigorously preached the idea that, we have just got to get with some things. We have to get the church out of the 1940s and current with everybody else. If we want to put people in the pew, we have to offer what all the other churches are offering. Well, that's pretty wide open. But that was some of the arguments that some were so bold to make. I mean, there are such things as it seems kind of small now, but the big issue then was about whether churches should have kitchens or not. Whether the church should have a kitchen so that, you know, that the brethren can have fellowship meals together. There were some that tried to make some doctrinal debates and reasoning on the idea of brethren having fellowship together. I'm all about having fellowship together. Their point and purpose is that having meals together is fellowship. Well, it's a sharing. I understand that. But it's not fellowship as we find in the Bible. Never is. Fellowship in the Bible never has anything to do with you know, fellowship of the church never has anything to do with a common meal. You know, we can't find that. And so during the 60s, there's this other debate going, as though there hasn't been enough, about kitchens and then fellowship halls. If you're going to have a kitchen, you have to have some place to put it, and you have to have a place for everybody to eat. And so there's an addition being built onto the building where there can be tables set up where everybody can eat. And in time, that turns into something a little bit more. The treasury is being used for this, in most cases at least. And so now the fellowship hall starts turning into more of a game room. There are some churches that build gymnasiums because the young people, the youth of the area, need to have some place to go after school. And there needs to be, you know, a place to shoot some hoops and play games in the winter time. Pretty soon, you know, in the church baseball league in town, there are churches of Christ that are on the baseball league and baseball teams and things like that. You know, I can remember that in when I was a kid growing up. And all kinds of social activities. And church becomes more of a social event thing. A lot of churches today, certainly, but even then, started having calendars on what was happening on Monday night and Tuesday night and Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, what kind of events were taking place. I've seen some of those calendars. I've looked at a whole month calendar before and not see one reference at all to anything spiritual. There's baseball, and there's soccer, and there's bingo night, and there's Valentine's Day, and there's everything such as this, but not anything at all about something spiritual. But this was the reason for the fellowship hall, or the gymnasium that was later built, or even some churches who have the Family Life Center. And now you have churches of Christ that have schools and daycares, all a part of the work of the church. It's hard for me to imagine how do we get there. And you know, for those who've been in this class from the beginning, going back months, and we think back to the studies that we did in the first few weeks about the very basic principles of the New Testament church that we read about in the Bible and the pattern that was set there about what is the church. And so we had a baseline. And then we try to measure that against what many people call church today. And it's not only that it's hard to find any resemblance, you can't find any resemblance. It doesn't look the same at all in some cases. How did it get there? Well, it wasn't overnight. I mean, again, do you remember in the 1860s when the church split? It was the issue of the missionary society, how the treasury was being used. And then there was the matter of instrumental music and worship. And do you remember we said, you know, in that period of time, for a few years after that split took place, I mean, but on the two sides, on matters of salvation, matters of most doctrine, moral issues, we had all been preaching the same thing. We had those two differences. Some have said, that's all that separated us, as though it was almost a minor thing. But how we saw through history that in a short period of time, those who were more liberal in their thinking with how Scripture should be used. I mean, it went beyond the missionary society. It went beyond instrumental music. And by 1900, those churches that had become known as Disciples of Christ or Christian Church were now very far away. And you remember some of the differences that we find today among those churches. The sacrament of baptism, they call it. And the ecumenical council, and women preachers, and of course, instrumental music, and no resemblance at all today with those churches and where we would stand. It didn't happen overnight. And when the division first took place, some said, there's hardly any difference between us. In the 1950s and 60s, there were still some when here, you know, new set of issues, but not really, it's all old. There would have been some, again, who would have said, well, I mean, besides how we use the treasury, I mean, we agree on salvation and doctrine and moral issues. There's just that one thing that separates us. But where are those churches today that in the 1950s and 60s were just saying, we need to use the treasury to support orphans and send money to colleges? Where are those churches today? Is that all that separates us today? I've had three or four people in the last couple of months that have said something to the effect like, I really want to understand more about what is some of the differences today among churches of Christ. This is it. This is what we're talking about. I mean, today, again, there are some tremendous differences among those who would call themselves churches of Christ. Many of them today not even calling themselves churches of Christ anymore. I'm thankful. Because what they are and what they do, what they practice, has no resemblance at all to what this book says. I'd rather them not call themselves a church of Christ, even if we have some things in common, because they're not following this pattern anymore. There is a distinctive nature to the Lord's church. He is the one who dictates what that nature should be. And this is the pattern that He gives us to follow for that. Where does it stop? Well, it doesn't. It doesn't stop.
There's one more that you need to add to that list of their wedding chapel. The College Church of Christ in Abilene, Texas has one.
Now, I hadn't heard that, but I wouldn't be surprised. And they probably charge money for people to come and get married, you know. I mean, I would imagine they would.
You know, it occurred to me, there seems to be almost an unconscious attitude when you get into all of the things of the social gospel, that the gospel in itself is no longer sufficient or effective in reaching people. So you've got to use something else. You've got to have something else to draw people in. And what happens, it seems to me, when you do that, is the gospel gets pushed aside.
Absolutely.
And these things that you use to draw the people in are the things that keep them there and the things that matter. And God doesn't want, Jesus didn't want that. In John chapter 6, He says, you're following me because you got fed.
Yeah.
And then He goes on to offend nearly everybody there.
And most leave.
Because He wants the true believers
yes.
to follow Him in that sense. And, you know, it just seems that we're totally missing the point of the gospel when we start doing things like that. God's wanting to change individuals one at a time. And I think a lot of people, they see the church as a means to rectify all the inequities in the world. Mm-hmm. That they think that the church exists to fix all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The church does not exist to fix that. It exists to draw people out of the world, mm-hmm. to illuminate, and then to give them a place where they can be fed and nurtured.
Spiritual.
And make them into effective teachers who will draw others out of the world.
Yes. Yes. Very, very awesome said. Yeah.
And if that happened, it would fix the problem.
Yes. It would. If we get that focused, you are right. Right.
How can you progress beyond God?
Okay. Beautiful segue. Because now there is the progressive movement among churches of Christ. Did you know we were going there? You know, the progressive movement. And, well, what does that mean? Well, it might depend who you talk to. Most of what I've seen of the progressive movement would be more accurately defined as the digressive movement. Because it's moving away from everything that God has given us. I want to make this point again. I already said this. back in the 1860s, the division that took place then, you had those churches that were trying to follow the New Testament pattern, look like the churches of the New Testament. And there were those who were wanting to introduce instruments of music, you know, into their worship. And supporting out the treasury, the missionary society and stuff like that. And within 40 or 50 years, there were great differences on where those churches went. And today, those churches, like we said, would include their sacrament of baptism. Most of them don't even believe in baptism for remission of sins. Disciples of Christ, Christian Church. Some would make an argument for that. Most do not. Ecumenical councils, you know, trying to make alliances with people of faith of all religions. You know, trying to justify, you know, all religions and all faith. Women leadership roles, denominational organization, having a headquarters and all of these kinds of things, instrumental music. You know, this is a pattern that's happening again now among churches of Christ. We're not talking about the Christian church. We're not talking about disciples of Christ. We're talking about mainstream churches of Christ today. Here's what's, you know, this progressive movement, Neil. You bring this up. This is right where we have to go. Those who call themselves the progressives today. Those who have been schooled by such colleges as Pepperdine and Harding and Lipscomb. All schools that were started by Christians, by members of the church years ago, over 100 years ago, had nothing to do with any association with churches as far as support or anything like that. Just some preachers that decided there should be, I want to start a school where godly people can go and get a good education. It's gone so far beyond that now. I mean, these are schools now that are just denominational in basis, really and truly, and have propagated this whole progressive movement. And today, there's a huge division taking place among the institutional churches of Christ, the mainstream churches of Christ. Those in the 1950s saying, I mean, we would have agreed on principles except the treasury being used for supporting the orphans' homes and the colleges. We would have agreed on everything else. We're not there now. And so the institutional brethren have, in the last 10 years or so, gone through an incredible split. I mean, it just a massive split. About almost 50% of their churches have split on that side. About 70% of the members of the mainline churches have moved to the progressives. People say, well, how do you get 70%? Well, it's mostly the large churches among the mainstream churches that have gone that way. So about 70% of those that we would have called institutional brethren 10 years ago are now aligning themselves more on this progressive movement. What's a progressive movement? Well, like Max Lucado. You know, 20 years ago, there were a lot of Christians were saying, man, there's some really good books available by Max Lucado. He's a preacher, member of the church. He's an institutional preacher. And he could sell a few books. He learned he could sell a whole lot more books if he wrote a little differently. And about 10, 12 years ago, he came to the point of saying baptism for remission of sins is not necessary. You're saved by faith only. Sold a lot more books. And, you know, the church that he has preached for years is just called, you know, Oak Hills Church now in Texas. They do not teach or believe baptism is necessary for remission of sins. They have contemporary worship. They have instrumental music. You know, all of these other kinds of things that we were talking about among the Christian church and things like that are accepting all of those kinds of things. That's where the progressive movement is going. Well, what pulled people that way? I don't know. I mean, is it in the influence of the megachurch? You know, trying to fill the pews? I'd love to fill the pews. There's only way we can fill the pews in a way that the Lord will be satisfied, and that is baptized believers, converts to His Word. That's the only thing that's going to satisfy Him. You know, the desire to appeal the masses, you know, and to try to talk or discuss some of these issues with those who are of the progressive movement is like spitting in the wind. Because we have nothing in common. You cannot discuss with them these issues on the basis of Bible authority. They don't accept Bible authority. That's not the basis of their faith. 50 years ago, almost anybody involved in that progressive movement would have never agreed with where the progressive movement is today. The leaders of the institutional movement in the 50s and 60s would have never agreed with where the progressive movement is today. But we've said before, once you breach Bible authority as the basis of how we draw conclusions, once you open that door, you cannot close it again. You can leave it and you can go back to the original, but you can't close that door.
The very first sin was the result of Satan getting Eve to question God's authority. You shall not surely die.
Mm-hmm.
He's been
doing everything. It's what he does. Does it well. Convincing. Can have many reasons why this is what needs to happen. This is what we should do. You know, among institutional churches now, which we said there's this big divide. There is sort of now. You know, I would call ourselves as a church that's just trying to follow the Bible pattern. Years ago, some would call us antis. I'm okay with that. Doesn't bother me. Some would say we're conservatives. Call me what you want. I'm just trying to follow the Bible pattern. It doesn't bother me. And then we had the institutions. Well, that's a split camp now. And so you might have the conservatives. Remember last time I said some things about, what do you call people, liberals or conservatives? And I kind of dug in a little bit on this idea of, I don't like calling people liberals because we need to be liberal. We need to be liberal in our giving. We need to be liberal in love. We need to be liberal in hospitality. Liberal does not define the issue. Institutional, non-institutional defines the issue. And so now we have the non-institutionals and we have the institutionals that are divided into two camps, conservative and liberal. That's where they are now. I held a meeting two or three months before I moved here, or maybe right after I moved here in Fayetteville, Tennessee. And one night there was a preacher that came, David Sane was his name, institutional preacher. His brother Paul Sane, institutional preacher in Pulaski, Tennessee. Really good men. I don't agree on how the treasury is, but we would not agree on that issue, but they are very conservative men. And he spoke of me some afterwards, and he's older than me. He must be about 70 or so. That's a lot older than me, in my mind. And he said, Brother Greer, he says, you know, if there comes a time that I'm going to have to move and try to preach somewhere else, I may have to call you non-institutional brethren to try to help find me a place to preach because my brethren have left me. That was his view on it. I thought that was interesting. I mean, he still would agree some things on the treasury that I would not agree with. And he knows that. But he was making the point that this progressive movement among the institutional brethren has gone so far left that he can't even recognize that was at one time resemblance of the Lord's church. And that's happened in just a few years. No, I mean, I know the breadcrumbs were put out a long time ago. I understand that. But it took a while for that to get set. It took a generation of lack of teaching, total lack of teaching on the issues, for there to come a time where there would be 35 and 40 and 45-year-olds who know nothing about the issues, and for someone to come in and say, well, you know, I just don't know why we couldn't have, you know, women teaching the adult Bible class. Well, I don't know why either. And they don't know why. Or, I don't know why we couldn't have instrumental music. Doesn't say you can't. And they don't know why. They've not been taught. They don't know what the Bible says. The breeding ground had been there for a while. It took a generation, maybe two. But now it's wide open. And that whole progressive movement, everything they do is not based on biblical authority. It's what we want the church to be. It doesn't happen overnight. But failure to understand how these things happen will cause it to happen again. Where will our children be? What about our grandchildren? What will they know? What convictions will they have? What are we teaching them? There's so much more I'd like to say on some of these things, and maybe, and there's some other issues that the church has had to deal with through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s. I don't know. Maybe we're going to try to deal with some. Specifically, some have asked about, what about the Boston movement, you know, and Crossroads and International Churches of Christ? Yeah, I think we should go there because that's still hot. You know, there's still things happening there. We need to talk about some things like that. Maybe sometime when Rick's gone, we'll try to deal with some things like that because we need to study that. But, you know, this has been a longer study than what I've anticipated we would spend in church history. Every time I teach something, it's longer, isn't it? It always goes longer than I think it will be, and I'm sure it seems even longer for you than me. But I hope it's been helpful. I hope it's been insightful in some way. And I appreciate so much your patience and your good comments.